yet risen. When he looked at his hands, he saw a black liquid on his fingertips. It had come from rubbing his eyes. He was suddenly frightened.
What is happening? Is this place cursed?
He got up, and Slynn looked over at him at once. Ironheart acknowledged him with a gesture and went over to ask if he had noticed anything strange. He could see the Fourthling clearly. He could discern every single ripple in the sand at his feet, and could hear the slightest of noises, even the very grains of sand as they were shifted by the breeze. But Ironheart knew perfectly well that his hearing was not good. All that noisy clanging and battering in battles had taken their toll, and in recent cycles he had been having trouble with the higher-pitched tones. But tonight it was different. After two paces he was overcome with thirst. The need was so strong that it could not wait until after he had talked to Slynn. So he turned on his heel and went back to where he had been lying to collect his flask. Ironheart drank and drank and drank, but the thirst could not be slaked. Water seemed to increase his need rather than quench it. Out of breath from drinking so fast, he tossed the flask aside and took hold of Balindar's. There was not enough coming out for his liking, so he took his knife to the pouch, forcing the last drop down his burning gullet. In a fury, he chucked the empty leather to the ground.
Fracas, what is wrong with me?
He was already stretching his hand out for the next soldier's drinking vessel. As he lifted his hand, he felt a sharp pain in his wrist. A scorpion had been hiding under the flask and had defended itself with its sting. Ironheart stamped on the insect and drew out his knife to open the wound and suck out the poison. But when he looked at his arm, he saw the wound was glowing yellow. There was a shimmer surrounding the sting. He could feel the heat coursing up his arm, and then the glow died away. Ironheart sat down on the sand.
Have I just healed myself from the poison? Or was that a miracle sent by Fracas?
Thirst flamed up once more, torturing him. He clutched at his throat with both hands to try to soothe his discomfort. Then he stuffed a handful of sand in his mouth to stop the burning sensation. It did not work. He swayed and tipped sideways as the stars above his head swirled and circled. Then the agony began. Ironheart was well acquainted with the pain of burns. He had suffered sword injuries or arrow wounds. He knew how it felt to have a dislocated shoulder or a sprained ankle. He had known toothache and fever. If he put all those tortures together and multiplied them tenfold, he was getting close to what he was now suddenly subjected to. His breathing stopped, and he could not move a muscle. His mind was drawn upwards to the stars, and he felt he was floating like a layer of gold leaf in the warm air of the forge. Then he tasted blood in his mouth, and all around abruptly went dark. Blinking, he saw the stars once more as tiny specks of light against the black firmament. Next to him, he saw a Zadar stowing away his flask and smiling at him.
It's that confounded, crazy troublemaker. It would have to be you, muttered Ironheart,
before he spat out a mouthful. He knew this taste well. It was that stuff that was apparently distilled elf water.
Did you just give me that Teon water?
The crazy Zadar bared his teeth and nodded.
It's the only thing that helps when you've got the bad thirst, he piped in a high voice like a castrato. It's the only thing. One drop and the fire dies down.
He chuckled and laid his finger to his black lips.
Sheesh! We must not tell anyone that I gave you some of that. Pascalin would be furious. We haven't got much of it, and it's the most precious thing we have.
Ironheart waited. His thirst had actually gone. Sand scrunched between his teeth, but there was no more water left to rinse his mouth out with.
It'll keep you going for a few orbits. Then the thirst will return,
the Zadar mouthed, giggling.
Do you notice how wonderful it makes life? The most obscure secrets of the universe make sense, and it makes you as strong as a giant.
He stood up and made an exaggerated bow.
Ironheart, Ironheart, soon you'll be one of us. A little bit like us. Your soul has changed colour and is starting to become as black as ours.
He fluted in his high-pitched tones, then adding in a bass note. Soon! He stepped back silently and rejoined his comrades, lying down on his blanket. Ironheart found it impossible to get back to sleep. He had been shown clearly that the liquid was not merely a herbal distillation, as he had at first hoped. Until now, he had completely forgotten that he had helped himself from another's flask. What did it all mean? And why, by Vracus, had it taken so long to show the effects? Tossing and turning on his blanket helped not a jot. He got up and went over to the Zadar.
"Oi, wake up," he said, shaking him by the shoulder. "Tell me what's happening to me."
The invisible's eyes opened, and a grin appeared on his face.
"Come with me."
He bounded up, grabbed the dwarf by the sleeve, and tugged him over to a gap in the rocks.
"Nobody must see us," he whispered. "It is forbidden to reveal our secrets."
He crouched down, pulling Ironheart down too.
"Elf blood, distilled, and..." "You told me that already. But is it the truth?"
Ironheart interrupted angrily.
"What is it doing to me? And how does it change the colour of my soul? Will I ever get to the Eternal Forge now? Will Vracus admit me?" "Perhaps not all of your soul,"
the Zadar conceded regretfully.
"Vracus may have to burn out the affected part and let the rest of you enter, if he is kindly disposed to you." "Listen, have you got a name?"
"Balodil,"
said the Zadar, the answer shooting out like an arrow.
"That's nonsense. That's the name the scholar took when he went into the beast's realm of eternal terrors."
"But it was mine first," came the sulky response.
Ironheart's eyes narrowed.
"Is that so? Then tell me who gave you that name."
Balodil said nothing but pointed silently at Tungdil as he slept.
"Of course," groaned Ironheart. "Vracus, what else do you have in store for me? A crazy Zadar who pretends to be the scholar's son?"
"He dropped me into the river when we were crossing on the bridge,"
said Balodil resentfully.
"I can remember how the current took hold of me and dragged me under. I couldn't breathe. Some time later I woke up. I was with some humans. They fed me and made me work for them, but then they sold me, and I escaped when the Alphar invaded."
He told his story quickly and without a pause.
"I ran all the way to the caves of Toboribor. I lived there for many, many cycles. That's all. I survived from orbit to orbit by stealing from the outlying farms, until Baskalin found me and took me off to join the Zadar."
He grinned, raising his arms and flexing his muscles.
"I'm the strongest of all of them."
Balodil pointed back to Tungdil.
"It was him that dropped me in the water. Even if he used to look different, I recognized him straight away."
Ironheart could hardly believe what he was hearing. A chilling story. Abstruse enough to be true?
It could all be a pack of lies. Did Tungdil maybe tell him about losing his son?
He shook his head. Very few people knew the story of Tungdil and Belindis' first child. The effect on Tungdil of the child's loss had nearly driven him mad with alcohol and grief. And after all the cycles that had passed in the meantime, there were so many other tales that could be told. Ironheart looked at Balodil and tried to spot similarities between him and Tungdil, or indeed Belindis. He saw no resemblance and was angry with himself for giving any credence to the words of a crazy Zadar.
"Whatever, Balodil. Just tell me what I can do about all this."
The Zadar glanced furtively back over his shoulder.
"You have the curse of the elves on you now. You don't mean to say you used their blood for this revolting stuff?" "Yes, we did. We found the last of the elves and took them prisoner. I thought the Alpha had eliminated all the pointy ears. No, they didn't get all of them. We finished the task off, all except two. They cursed us all and anyone who would partake of the drink. If anyone can free you from the stain of your soul, it will be one of the two elves still alive.
Baladil cocked an ear.
I must get back to the others. Baskelin has woken up. If I'm away too long, he'll think something's wrong.
He put his hands on Ironheart's shoulders.
Swear you'll not betray me. Nobody must know that we spared the lives of two of the elves. Not until all the Alpha have been wiped out.
The grip on his shoulders was painful.
All right, I swear for Vrakas's sake.
Baladil released him and disappeared into the shadows.
What do I do when the thirst comes back?
Ironheart asked in a muffled whisper.
I'll be there, and I'll help you slake your thirst, came the answer out of the dark.
He sighed.
Vrakas, whenever I think it can't get any worse, you have a surprise in store for me,
he grumbled.
My soul is besmirched. I have an elf curse on me, and the only pointy ears who might be able to help me, well, no one knows where they are, or if they're even still around.
He fiddled with his trousers, preparing to give some dwarf water to the desert.
Oh, and let's not forget the monsters of the Black Abyss and Lot Ionan, who we have to defeat but mustn't kill. All the usual suspects for a dwarf like me to contend with. Anyone would think it was some marketplace bard coming up with this tale. Perhaps you've got a pet storyteller, Vrakas, giving you ideas.
He directed his dwarf water to describe at least the first letter of his name in the sand. He was not surprised in the slightest to note that his stream ran black as ink before it trickled away between the grains of sand. Chapter 25. Girdlegard, former queendom of Sangpur, southwest, spring 6492nd solar cycle. They left the belt of sand behind them, marched through fields of boulders, traversed valleys and skirted ravines in which, numberless cycles earlier, vast rivers had run. Now they were met only with dust, stones, and the occasional bleached skeleton. This stretch of the Sangpur Desert appealed to Ironheart because it resembled his old habitat, with its soaring rock walls, its chasms, its echoes, its subterranean passages, here cut by racing water and not by dwarf hand. The landscape had something primeval to it.
I could almost start to like it here, if it weren't hotter than the inside of a maniac's forge.
Today they were making their way through a labyrinth of sunken walkways in which Franek, at the head of the company with Tungdil and Baskelin, kept getting lost. It was only thanks to the dwarves that they ever found their way out again. One of the Zadar climbed up high to get a better view and pointed them in the right direction for the east.
Our water supplies are running out. We should have got to the village you told us about 3 orbits ago, said Tungdil. If we don't reach it tomorrow, you're for the chop, Thimulis, for having tricked us. I think you're taking us round in circles, hoping we die of thirst.
The man gasped.
Oh, sure. I'm taking myself round in those circles to die with you. Not a good move. Who says you don't have a secret reservoir near here?
Ironheart moved up to the head of the column.
What kind of a village did you say it was?
A desert market, a trading station. We'll get everything we need. They used to sell dwarf-made goods there, weapons particularly. Even today, you can get some quite rare items.
Franek looked down at the clothes he was wearing, marked over and over with salt rings.
They know me there.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
Ironheart laughed.
I like to be prepared. I'd like to know whether they'll greet us at Spear Point, because we have you with us.
We'll be safe enough. The town belongs to me.
He drew in a hot lungful of air.
Well, it was mine, until Lot Ionan chucked me out.
What was your research area? I don't remember, or maybe you never said.
Ironheart looked at Balindar, who carried the slit water pouch at his belt. He had assumed the damage must have been an accident. Perhaps he had dreamed that the pouch was the head of an orc rising up out of the sand to attack him. Then he must have slashed at it with his knife. After hearing this, none of the others cared to sleep in his immediate vicinity. Behind Balindar came the Zadar, who called himself Balodil. Ironheart had stopped believing that he might really be the scholar's own son. The age did not seem right. Baskalin told them that only old dwarfs were taken into the ranks of the Zadar. The real Balodil would not have been old, at least not old for a dwarf. "I was studying how to maximize size in animals and in things," answered Frannic.
"Ah," grinned Ironheart. "That will have made you popular with the ladies, I'll be bound." "It's not what you think, Beardface," the Famulus retorted. "You, of course, could do with a bit of growth. If you were a few hands taller, you'd be able to breathe the same air as I do." "I could easily bring you down to size, Longan. I've got an ironclad winner of a spell. I'd only have to let it circle."
Ironheart lifted the crow's beak, but lowered it when he caught Tungdil's disapproving eye.
"Just wait," he grumbled.
"Did you have any luck?"
the one-eyed dwarf inquired.
"The experiments with plants worked all right. Same thing with simple animal life. Insects were good as well."
"Hey! How about a giant guggle?"
bellowed Ironheart.
"First a wonderful fight with the beast, and then a magnificent feast."
He gave Frannic a playful shove.
"See? Tell us, how much did you get things to grow?"
"The body of the giant scorpion that I magicked must have measured 7 paces from tail to tip," Frannic said, putting on a self-important face. "My experiments consisted of getting grasshoppers to grow large enough for us to ride on. They would be splendid mounts for the desert, but there was a high turnover rate. They kept dying on us."
"Are we far enough away from the place you practice your spells? I don't like scorpions, and I certainly don't like them when they're that big."
Ironheart was remembering a particular example they had met the night before. The pincers of a giant scorpion would surely grab a warrior and slice him in two, complete with his armor, and the huge sting would stab right through instead of poisoning him. No, he really did not want to meet one of those.
"This is exactly where I conducted my experiments," Frannic laughed. "But there is nothing left of them now. I didn't want them to take over and destroy the town. Of course, I may have overlooked some of their young."
"Charming,"
said Slynn, taking his crossbow in his hands. The Zadar, watching their progress from on high as he leaped like a rock ape from one stone to the next, reported that he could see a settlement at the end of the ravine they were marching through. He came back down to join them. The company followed his instructions and took one more turn in this confusing maze of intersecting clefts. There was no question. In front of them lay a town. But part of it was under a huge sand dune and stood empty and abandoned. The low, flat-roofed buildings, painted white against the sun, all looked intact, but there was no sign of life in the streets. Frannic turned to Tungdil flabbergasted.
"Less than 40 cycles ago, there were 40,000 people living here, I swear!"
"Lot Ionan is not just out to get you, but plans death for everyone connected to you, I expect," said Ironheart. "Vicious old man. He's working out his grievance."
"What a fool!"
Frannic's display of anger did not seem simulated.
"They weren't to blame."
"Does the town have a well?"
Tungdil asked, indifferent to Frannic's fury.
"Yes."
"Then let's get there."
Tungdil set off, the group in his wake.
"Be prepared for absolutely anything. Lot Ionan, or whoever has done this, will be expecting Frannic to turn up sooner or later."
As he walked, he drew his weapon, Bloodthirster, and his lips moved in silent prayer. Ironheart felt the familiar, enjoyable tension creeping up his spine. With his crow's beak in his left hand, he kept constant watch on their surroundings.
please, no giant scorpions.
Together with the humans, he kept to the edge of the road, while the watchful Zadar whooshed past, using the house roofs and side streets, on the lookout for any ambush or trap. Franek led them through the alleyways to a small square measuring 10 paces by 10. The houses, roundabouts, were tiny. The remnants of old market stalls lay tumbled on the flagstones, many of which were cracked or broken. Others showed deep ruts. Ironheart observed the scene.
Something massive crashed down here.
Slynn bent down and picked up a golden bracelet.
Will you look at that? He said, showing it to the others. It was just lying there.
He examined the piece with expert eyes.
This is a splendid example of a goldsmith's craft. I would say it's worth about 400 gold coins.
This used to be the jeweler's market, said Franek,
going over to the fountain in the middle of the square. He tasted the water that came splashing out of a stone pillar to collect in a basin.
It's safe. The source of this water can't be got at to poison it. At least, it would be terribly difficult. It comes from a very long way down underground.
Could probably be done by magic, though.
Ironheart continued to scan the windows of the houses. Franek filled his drinking pouch.
No, I would have noticed.
And how would you have done that, Clever Clogs?
Ironheart was not going to be fobbed off so easily.
I am a magus, so I have an instinct.
He indicated Koira.
Get her to check it out if you don't believe me.
The mager, who, like Radario and Millennia, was suffering from bad sunburn, came closer and pretended to announce a spell. She had to rely on the judgment of the Famulus, because she did not want to waste the last of her magic on apparently trivial matters. Her already limited powers were waning further, at any rate evaporating like water in the heat of the sun. She was desperate to reach the magic source in the Blue Mountains and steep herself in it before her deformed arm rotted away. Looking at her, Radario was aware she was keeping up a pretense, deceiving the dwarves as to her state of health.
There is no magic contamination, she announced.
Franek looked triumphant and superior.
Ironheart gave in, and everyone started to fill their flasks.
Tungdil told Slynn to put the bracelet back.
It's not yours. Perhaps the townspeople will come back, and they'd call you a thief.
One of the Zadar up on the roof called out a warning. Baskalin turned to the one-eyed dwarf and interpreted.
They've spotted some bodies. He says they look as if a butcher has been at them. The flesh has been scraped off and the bones smashed. Judging from the state of the cadavers, they think it must have happened about 10 orbits ago.
Franek went and sat down in the shade, joining the other humans.
Lot Ionan has no army. It could perhaps have been bandits that did this, but my feeling is that Lot Ionan, or maybe Bermina, sent a magic creature to kill them or drive them all out of the town.
He turned to Koira.
You'll have to be more on your guard. Do us a discovery spell, so that we'll know if we're safe.
Yes, do that, Tungdil urged her. I don't want to walk into an ambush so close now to our goal. You'll be able to see more than the Zadar can.
Koira was about to object, but her curiosity got the better of her. Tungdil knew very well that she had practically no magic left at her disposal. Why was he making such a demand? Did he have no idea at all how much effort casting a spell would involve?
I'll do it from up there, she said,
nodding to Radario to accompany her into the nearest large house. They climbed the steps, going up 2 floors to stand on the whitewashed roof of a building that gave them a good view of the whole settlement.
Are you really going to do it? The actor asked her.
Yes,
she lied.
It's to protect all of us.
She waved her arms about, closed her eyes once, then opened them, and turned round 3 times on the spot.
I don't feel anything. We're safe. But nevertheless we should hurry. I'm uneasy. I'll tell Tungdil so, before he decides we should camp here.
Radario took her hand. I'm glad to see your hand is still in its rightful place.
For a while, at least, but I shan't be able to do much more.
She smiled at him and they returned to the others so that the Maga could make her report to the High King. She made no secret of her feelings of disquiet about the place.
Have you noticed the vultures are missing? It's unnatural. They only come down to feast if they know they won't be disturbed.
That alone, she argued, was reason enough for departing swiftly from the town.
That may be so, but it's you, Maga, in particular, I'm thinking of when I order a rest stop.
Tungdil, over by the fountain, commanded the Zadar to investigate the neighboring houses and to move in if they found no danger.
The day is too hot for us to march on, and anyway, we are close now to the Blue Mountains. I've agreed with Baskalin that we should travel at night and rest by day. That way we should avoid being seen.
He collected water in his open hand and washed his face. A droplet hanging from the eye patch shimmered gold in the light.
As there are no magic traps, there's no reason we shouldn't remain here for a time, right?
Koira hesitated, then nodded.
No reason not to.
She went back into the house with Rodario, her conscience pricking her. Her right arm was burning and throbbing, not a good sign. Curiosity got the better of Ironheart, Slynn, and Balindar, overcoming their professed intentions and their common sense. They wandered round the streets, ready for combat, searching abandoned houses for signs of recent occupation. The Zadar were protecting the group at the jeweler's market, and the three dwarves felt strong enough to see off any attacks by robbers or wild animals. Slynn held his crossbow against his shoulder.
"We should make less noise," he said.
Balindar laughed at him.
"That's because you're the one with a weapon that always has to be reloaded."
Ironheart grinned.
"Come on, let's find where they traded dwarf goods," he suggested,
turning down one of the side streets, where he saw two crossed hammers on a sign over a shop doorway. That was a good enough clue for him. It might be a blacksmith's. He would feel at home there. He wiped the sweat off his forehead.
"I hope they'll have some oil for my chainmail. I'm nearly out of it."
"What shall we do if we find things our own folk have made?"
Slynn wanted to know.
"Can we take them with us?"
"That's what I was thinking. I don't envy the Longans their wealth, but if the town is going to disappear under yet more sand, I'd like to salvage things made by our own tribes."
Ironheart stepped into the shop, where he found tools of every sort, ranging from nail clippers to quarry drills. Two of them sifted through the items on show, while the third kept watch outside. They worked their way from shop to shop until they reached the edge of the immense dune. A number of booths had already been half-swamped by the encroaching sands, and it proved to be these that were advertising dwarf wares. The trio hesitated at the buildings, whose facades were cracked. They knew that the sand represented an enormous weight, even if the individual grains were so light.
"Looks dangerous to me," said Slynn. "But it might be worth the risk."
Balindar gestured with the morning star toward a sign reading, "Weapons made by the children of Vrakas." The door had already been broken open, and swords, spears, and axes lay scattered around.
"Someone's already done their shopping, it seems, without asking the owner."
Ironheart rubbed his cheeks, tossed his black plait out of the way, and strode in. It was obvious that he had made his decision.
"Slynn, you stand guard," he ordered. "If the roof falls in, at least one of us will survive."
"That's a nice thought,"
the fourthling beamed. He stayed outside under the porch while Ironheart and Balindar stepped carefully over a heap of daggers, knives, and axes. It was clear at once that they had stumbled on a small treasure trove, but it had already been pillaged. The display cases were empty, the glass fronts shattered. Only the normal run of weapons, still, however, of excellent quality, remained hanging on the walls or from the ceiling.
"What a shame," said Balindar, as he stepped over the mess. "This stuff on the floor isn't dwarf manufacture," muttered Ironheart, crouching down. "They're forgeries," he snorted, The robbers could obviously tell the difference between quality stuff and fake.
By Vrakas! Balindar called out excitedly. Ironheart hurried over.
Do you see what I see?
The warrior saw a cabinet with a broken pane of glass. Inside was a velvet cushion, and below that was a piece of parchment with wording in human language. The legendary Keenfire. The original weapon. Next to it lay a little booklet and a certificate verifying authenticity, issued by the shopkeeper, one Esuo Wopcat, and vouchsafing the return of the purchase price should the weapon prove to be a forgery. Ironheart laughed outright.
Yet another of them!
I know they were a real hit with the souvenir shops, said Balindar, reaching into the vitrine to retrieve the booklet. This says how it was found.
Let me guess,
called Ironheart, enthusiastic as a young child with a riddle.
Let's see. It was found this time on the top of the dragon's tongue? Or in the caves of Taboribor? No, wait. In the lost vaults of Lotaionan?
No. None of those. Balindar cleared his throat and began to read. Esteemed customers, collectors, and experts. The axe you hold in your hands is made from the purest, most durable of steel. The claws at the end are of stone. The handle is made of Sigurdacea wood. The inlays and runes are from all the rare metals to be found in the mountains. The blade, however, is edged in diamonds. The weapon was forged in the hottest furnace possible. The name of the item is Keenfire. Forget everything you have heard from the charlatans. This one is the only true Keenfire. It was found on the dried-up floor of Wayan's Lakes and was smuggled out of the land under the greatest of perils for the finder. The location was near the hole from which Lohasbrand emerged. I am not able to say how this occurred. A fisherman's son brought the axe to me, saying his cousin had found it. He had shown it to a dwarf who recognized its true value and killed the man. However, while fleeing, the dwarf needed to cross a river and drowned, when justice and the curse of Elria triumphed. The fisherman wanted nothing to do with the axe because he feared the dwarves would attack him for it, so he sent his son to me with it. I made him a very good offer, and so was able to take possession of Keenfire. I know it is the legendary axe with which Tungdil Goldhand performed so many valiant deeds for Girdlegard. I was intending to keep it safely against his return, but without him it has no power, so I've decided to part with it, for gold. Should the hero ever return, give him this axe. I am certain he will amply reward you. Sincerely, Esuo Wopcat. Ironheart whistled.
That's the best story so far. At least the facts seem to match up nicely.
How do you mean?
It sounds genuine. If I remember rightly, the last unslayable ran off with Keenfire and threw it away en route when we were pursuing him. Ironheart beamed. He will have thought a lake would be the last place a dwarf would want to search for it, so he tossed it into the water before he went down the shaft.
You don't really believe it, do you?
Balindar shut the little book and chucked it back into the broken cabinet.
And anyway, the thing's been stolen. It could be anywhere by now.
Hey there,
said Slynn at the entrance, holding up a dusty axe. Look what I found outside in the dirt. It was smack in front of my boots. Ironheart and Balindar looked at each other. The fourthling blew the encrusted sand off.
I don't know what kind it is, but I'll have a better idea when I've given it a bit of a wash.
He inspected the blade.
Are those diamonds? Who do...
He noticed the other two were staring at him. Then he fell silent, swallowing hard.
By Vrakas!
He croaked in awe, kneeling down and placing the axe reverently on the ground in front of him.
By Vrakas!
Said Balindar and Ironheart simultaneously, coming over to the doorway and crouching down to look at the weapon. Ihart took his drinking flask from his belt and poured some water onto the axe head to reveal some of the fine detail.
Ah! His voice died away. Charming!
Slynn heard a chinking sound behind the two dwarves and raised his crossbow. He saw a dagger slip forward in the cabinet, fall off the shelf and drop onto the counter. He was just drawing breath again in relief when he noticed a sword releasing itself from its fastenings and sailing down to the counter as well.
Something weird is happening here,
he told his companions, who were intent on examining the runes and inlays.
We must warn the others.
Just shoot the silly mouse if you're scared of it,
Balindar said briskly, misinterpreting the sounds.
Yes, before Franek's spell makes it grow the size of an ox, added Ihart,
completing the thought as he ran his fingers carefully along the axe blade.
Well, I'll be damned.
Slynn had leaped up, not wanting to believe his eyes. Shields, lances, daggers, swords, and other weapons were zooming together from all corners of the room to make a monster with human form, a deadly creation born from magic.
Absolutely charming. I fear the Maga wasn't using the right spell when she checked this place out for safety, he said, speaking very fast.
Oh, so it is a giant mouse,
the fifthling mocked.
Turn around and look, you idiots,
snapped Slynn, aiming his bow at the creature, well aware that this would not help. Franek had told them that only magic itself could overcome one of these creatures.
Mind yourself, Jim Cutter. You can't talk to me like that just because we let you travel with us. It doesn't mean I like you, and I won't be spoken to like that.
Ihart was about to tear his eyes away from the newfound axe when it picked itself up and whirled past their noses. An unseen power dragged his crow's beak from his grasp, and Balindar lost his morning star.
What?
At last they turned round and saw their enemy, an enemy they now faced unarmed. The creature had formed a massive hand composed of knives. It was holding Keenfire up and the handle of the crow's beak pointing down. The being clattered its way over toward the dwarf trio. Ihart realized now where the marks on the flagstones at the jeweler's market had come from, and he knew also who had stripped the meat off the bones of the corpses they'd found. He grabbed Balindar by the sleeve, pulled him up, and they walked backwards very slowly.
"Why didn't you warn us, fourthling?" the fifthling growled.
Slynn laughed mirthlessly.
"Good joke! You were both immersed in axe worship."
He pointed with his crossbow at the creature. "It's over there, if you still want it."
"I certainly do,"
Ihart nodded, frowning and lowering his head between his shoulders aggressively.
"I don't mind the blades. No one is going to threaten me with my own weapon."
He lifted up a wooden strut from a broken cabinet and whacked the enemy with it. There was a click, and the arm made of spears and lances whirred, rotating like a drill, crashing into the wood. Ihart was showered with sawdust and found his hands were empty.
"Confounded!" he turned in dismay. "Let's get out of here!"
He ran off with Slynn and Balindar at his heels. They charged down the street side by side.
"Which way?"
asked the fifthling, glancing round at the artificial monster, which was just emerging, doubled up, from the shop doorway. The weapons that had been lying in a heap in front of the shop rushed up to fuse with all the others.
That was not all.
Clicking and scraping, the steel and magic creature changed shape, giving itself three extra pairs of legs and thinning down its core so that it turned into a spider, setting off after them.
"We've got to lure Keenfire back to Tungdil. He'll be able to take it for himself," panted Ihart as he ran. "I'm incensed that I'm having to run away from my own weapon."
They rounded the corner into an alleyway too narrow for the spider creature to fit through. But when they heard the rattling and clattering come closer, nobody had to turn and look in order to know the thing pursuing them had transformed itself again. It was chasing them through the streets as if it were herding stampeding guggles. Rodario was sitting in front of the house in the shade with a few sheets of paper, noting down his thoughts with a quill pen. He had composed some lines on liberty and adventure. Millennia brought him out a glass of water. As she passed it to him, her fingers touched his hand, as if by accident. They looked at each other. "How is Koira?" he asked, his eyes returning to the page. "Quite weak now from the long march. If you grow up in a land where water is the dominant element, you have a tough time in the desert." Millennia dropped her voice. "You know, she's hardly got any magic left." He looked at her in surprise. "How do you..." "She told me. She says she's only got about a third of the magic energy she would normally have. The amount grows smaller orbit by orbit. We must get her to the source as quickly as possible." She drank some water. "We can only hope the gods preserve us from any magic attacks." Rodario went on writing and asked, "What else did she tell you?"
"What else?"
Millennia's tone of voice indicated sharp attention.
"Is there something else?"
"No." He tried to change the subject. "I mean, I don't know. You women seem to like having secrets, so I thought I might learn something new. Who else knows about her difficulties?"
"Tungdil and Boindil, that's all. That's the way it has to stay."
She glanced at his notes. "What are you doing there?"
"I'm writing. For what's about to happen." "Not the fight against Lot Ionan."
"No, for after that. It's just ideas. The descendants of the incredible Rodario will take them to the people of Gerdligard as soon as the battle for the future has been won. The unknown poet has done his duty as a freedom fighter. But our work as actors and bards is not over." He was unusually serious, almost statesmanlike. "We must establish order quickly before greedy despots emerge to usurp powers they are not entitled to." Rodario offered her a seat next to him. "I should like to ensure it is you and no one else that sits on the throne of Eidoslane."
"That's good of you."
The Eido girl sat down by him and stared at the fountain. "Were you offended by the kiss I gave you?"
"No."
He put his pen down. "I got the impression you were no longer interested in me." She sipped her drink, then turned her head. "Stupidly enough, I am still keen on you, even if I can hardly wait for the return of my old shy Rodario."
"He's still around, deep inside," he replied with a smile.
Then he took a deep breath. "Women don't like sharing their men, so I think it's only fair to say I ought to release you and concentrate my attentions on Koira. You may laugh, but the Maga and I have already discussed this." Millennia smiled. "The latest state of play is that we don't mind sharing you." Now Rodario had to put the paper and quill pen aside.
"You've done what?"
"We did what men always want us to do. We came to an agreement," she repeated, and raised her hand to stroke his cheek. "So you don't have to decide between us, Rodario, and we won't be scratching each other's eyes out or declaring war on each other's realms." She smiled and was delighted by his reaction. Suddenly, he looked vulnerable again. The helpless Rodario she found so attractive was back. "There's one condition, however. You will never share a bed with both of us at the same time."
I don't believe what I'm hearing," he laughed, half in amusement, half in astonishment. "And I really don't know..."
He got up and paced up and down across the square.
"I really don't know if I like this idea."
"Ah, so it bothers your manly nature to hear that two women have set the rules this time."
"No,"
he said at once.
Or perhaps yes."
He scratched his head, then his beard.
"This has never ever happened to me before," he muttered.
He came to a standstill and put his hands on his hips, staring at the blonde warrior girl.
"Who do you think you are?"
he burst out indignantly.
"Who, me?"
Millennia pointed to herself.
"No, both of you, Koira and you. You've sworn sisterhood. You want to make me your slave. But you never..."
he said, wagging his forefinger, "thought to let me in on the secret." He kicked the ground. "I feel humiliated and abused." She was speechless. "Here I am, telling you that two girls are in love with you, and that you can have both of them, and you throw a tantrum like a jealous child." She put her head back and laughed out loud. "How very, very sweet. Ah, this is the other Rodario you're showing me, just to please me. How kind of you." "What?" He waved his arms about in exasperation. "Ye gods, what is the world coming to?" Millennia stood up, a grin on her face. "Stop," he called as she approached him. "Stay where you are. Before I know it, you'll be wanting to kiss me because you think I'm so sweet."
"Exactly."
"And adorable."
"True."
She was nearly upon him, but he dodged and banged his hip on the stone fountain.
"What do we have to do to rid you of your bad mood? Perhaps we should let you think you have seduced us both."
Millennia's tone was mocking, and she was amused to see him blush. It was hard to see how the calm, eloquent Rodario, who had been philosophizing about Gerdlegard's future, and this infuriated man, could be one and the same person. At least she knew now how to make her pet Rodario put in an appearance. The actor raised his hands to push her away.
"Don't come too close. I'll have to give the matter a lot of thought before I kiss either one of you ever again."
"Yes, you will," she said, laughing and turning away. "You'll find me with Coira." Rodario perched on the edge of the fountain, reached into the water, and cooled his face.
"Women," he murmured, "sharing me out, me! The very nerve of it!"
The water ran down to the tip of his nose, over his cheeks and mouth, into his smart little beard. He felt a little calmer. Of course he was attracted to the Ido girl, and the thought of having both women really was not to be sneezed at. But actually, he felt insulted. His masculine pride was hurt, his Rodario pride. How could this be happening to a descendant of the incredible Rodario? He should be conquering hearts, not being haggled over and shared out like a sack of grain.
"To make a pact like that, what a nerve," he muttered, feeling the cool dampness dripping onto his shoulder as the water soaked through his shirt.
The fountain was splashing more loudly now. It was so hot that he did not find this unwelcome, but he could not explain why the jet of water had changed direction. Rodario turned his head and froze. Towering 4 paces high behind him was a being similar to a human, but formed entirely of water. It had a broad head and a snout-like face with long teeth, teeth made of solid water. Turning round again, he pretended he had not noticed anything untoward as he peeled himself away from the stone surround of the fountain and walked over to the house entrance. He must call Coira to come and see this phenomenon and tell him what it was. It was really not the normal way for a fountain to conduct itself. The splashing grew louder. Then he heard the Zadar calling down from the rooftops and felt a wave swirl around his legs. In an instant, it had pulled him off his feet, and he disappeared into the water, spluttering madly. Coira opened her eyes, having felt something cold on her forehead. Millennia was sitting next to her, wiping her face with a damp cloth.
"This time you're looking after me," she said weakly.
"You have heat stroke," replied the Ido girl.
"Rodario should have been taking better care of you. You had a talk with him, I heard."
Millennia passed her something to drink.
"I told him that we had agreed to share him."
The Mager felt giddy.
"But he was not to be told anything at all," she protested. "You've broken our agreement on purpose." "It didn't make sense otherwise. One of these days he was going to work out for himself that we women had made common cause, and that we were in charge, not him.
He can take out his anger on me. It's not your fault. Koira sighed and emptied her glass. So that's why he was shouting. He looked so cute, the Ido girl said dreamily. He was as helpless as a young child again. You would have given him to me straight away, if you'd seen him like that. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw something move in the shadows, in a corner where a pile of bricks was stacked. Hadn't they moved too? They seemed to have formed a little tower. She furrowed her brow. It's this confounded heat, she said. I can't take the heat. What did Rodario say? He said he'd have to think about it. I knew it. Now he'll reject both of us. Koira sat up where she had been lying. That really wasn't very bright. Keep calm, Millennia told her, clasping her hand. He has a head on his shoulders and will soon realize what he is being offered. What we have offered him. If he throws this opportunity away, he's too stupid to be a companion to either of us. The Maga thought hard, then smiled shyly.
Maybe. I don't fancy stupid men.
Millennia caught another movement in the same corner. The bricks were actually moving closer together. She stared at the place intently. The bricks were forming stacks and piling up wildly. They shaped a leg, but then the supply ran out, so square bricks broke out of the wall as if following some silent command. Koira's attention was caught by this movement too. The brick creature was growing taller by the minute, and, at the same time, the fabric of the walls was becoming steadily more damaged, until they started to cave in. Outside, the Zadar was shouting. Millennia dragged the Maga up, seeing giant cracks appear in the roof above their heads.
Let's get out, quick! The building's going to collapse!
The two girls ran to the door, but they were met by a wall of water with Rodario swimming within it, trying to get out. The rear of the building crashed down.
Get out, through the window at the back,
the Ido ordered, tugging Koira along.
Didn't you say there was no magic here?
The Maga had no answer. The shock was overwhelming, as was the realization that she must bear the responsibility and guilt for allowing their party to walk into a trap. Chapter 26. Girdlegard, former Queendom of Sangpur, Southwest, Spring, 6492nd Solar Cycle.
Is it still tailing us?
Iahart turned left and found himself in a wider lane that seemed unfamiliar.
How did that happen?
They appeared to have got lost trying to escape.
This confounded maze!
No!
Slynn called out, bringing up the rear.
I can't see it anymore!
I know why!
Barked Balindar, stopping in his tracks and grabbing Iahart by the collar.
It's in front of us!
The creature, made of shields, spears, daggers, knives, swords, and countless other weapons, rounded the corner. It had taken on a shape vaguely like a scorpion with six sets of pincers snapping open and shut.
Charming! Said Slynn, pointing to the right. Get in here! The alley will be too narrow for it!
Then it'll just turn itself into a snake,
Iahart replied in a fury.
It can pursue us wherever we go. Running away is no use at all.
Yes, it is. It means we stay alive until we've thought of a way to outwit it,
wheezed the fourthling.
Shoot it with your crossbow, Balindar snapped. You're never able to keep up with us anyway.
Iahart was racking his brains. Only magic would get them out of this spot. But if they could not find their way back to the Queen, they were wasting their time. All this running was tiring them out, and the steel creature would fall on them and scrape the flesh off their bones. He caught sight of his own crow's beak dangling at the end of the poisonous sting. Balindar's Morning Star was next to it.
What works with iron?
He mused wildly, getting nowhere.
Rust,
suggested Balindar sarcastically.
An enormous magnet, said Slynn. What a great idea.
And where do you propose we get one of those? Can you find us a pulling stone big enough to attract and immobilize 400 sackfuls of iron and steel? The fifthling mocked. And what about the rust idea? Where'd you get that all of a sudden? Slynn snarled back. The creature was drawing close, so they had to charge on. Ironheart thought the pulling stone idea was not to be discounted. Such magnets were fashioned from a mineral that made most metals, including iron, stick to it. Only gold, silver, and other precious metals were unaffected.
But to stop this enemy, we'd need a whole mountain of magnets. It's a waste of time just hanging around waiting for a miracle. Time is one thing we don't have. We split up, he commanded.
Won't the creature just do the same? Whimpered Slynn.
You're the only one of us with a weapon. All we can do is chuck stones at it.
Balindar sounded as angry as Ironheart felt. Then Slynn did something unexpected. He stopped, got down on one knee, and lifted his crossbow.
Anybody know where a scorpion keeps its heart? He asked,
his voice determined, as he took aim at the creature, which was twirling its various weapons in the air and approaching fast. Its sword legs scraped and clicked their way over the flagstones.
Forget it! It's hopeless! Come with us!
Ironheart was about to grab hold of him, but the fourthling shook his hand off.
Just tell me where its heart will be!
Balindar picked up a rock and threw it at the creature.
It's made of iron and magic. It can't be shot down.
They saw how the stone, shortly before hitting its target, was grabbed by the metal pincers and crushed.
Oh, that's my crow's beak! You'll ruin it if you use it on stone, shouted Ironheart.
Slynn had made his decision. He pointed the device down slightly, aimed, concentrated, and fired. The bolt whizzed off. The shot was too fast for their foe's reflexes. It whirred in between the edges of two shields and buried itself in the body. There was a clatter, and the whole creature fell and disintegrated. But the various parts, swords, daggers, spears, and other blades, had not lost their momentum. A whole arsenal was flying directly at the three dwarves. The weapons' combined weight alone would have been lethal.
"Move aside!"
yelled Ironheart, throwing himself through a closed door, which burst open at the first impact. Surrounded by bits of wood, he found himself in a hallway. He could feel something on his foot, but no pain. He quickly rolled onto his back to check on his companions. He sighed with relief when he saw they had dodged the hail of weapons by diving for cover under a courtyard arch. The alley they had all been standing in was littered with steel weapons that had buried themselves in the flagstones.
I'll never criticize a crossbow again, or Slynn for that matter,
Ironheart mumbled. He stood up, dusted himself off, and stepped out into the sun. Now he could see the extent of the damage. Flying weapons had sunk into the very walls.
I don't believe it,
said Balindar, looking at Slynn, who was grinning as he reloaded his crossbow.
What are those bolts made of? Let's use them against Lot Ionan.
Koira and Millennia suddenly stood before them. It was obvious who they really had to thank for their deliverance. Slynn made a face, and the fifthling laughed. They retrieved their own weapons from the tumble of iron and steel, not forgetting Keenfire, before hurrying to join the ladies.
We were just in time,
said Millennia, staring at the alleyway that bristled with weapons.
We met similar creatures back where we were resting.
Ruckus! I've a bone to pick with her!
Ironheart planted himself squarely in front of the Maga.
Didn't you tell us there was no magic here? Perhaps you're not as good at your job as you profess to be,
he complained, until Rodario interrupted.
Not now. We have to get back to protect the others from the water creature. There was a stone creature following us as well, but Koira dealt with that one.
Millennia supported her friend, who had gone very pale in spite of the sunburn. Ironheart feared she might have next to no magic powers still at her disposal.
Follow us! The dwarves checked behind, and then the five of them clambered over bricks and broken roof tiles to reach the jewelry market.